Now, another BloomerBoomer.com podcast. Your host, Andy Asher, living life over 55. Do you remember when?
Do you remember when?
Do you remember when?
Our government, unlike many governments, and particularly the governments of where the people that founded this country came from, is a government that is derived from the people. The consent to govern.
That's Dan Quayle, born February 1947, serving as the 44th Vice President of the United States, serving with President George H.W. Bush from 89 to 1983. He also served as a U.S. Representative and U.S. Senator from the state of Indiana. Well, hi, everyone. Today's podcast takes on the topic of diabetes. Now, there's so much in the media today about it, and anyone who sees their doctor on a regular basis knows the risks of developing diabetes increase as we get older. So when a story comes around that can teach us and enlighten us about something important in life, well, I try to share it. So today we talk with Amy Ryan, who tells us her compelling story of how her definition of a normal life changed dramatically many years ago, still at a time when she was a young woman, ready to launch her law career and along with a new relationship. And after a lingering infection, she was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Let's talk to Amy Ryan, author of Shot, Staying Alive with Diabetes. First of all, thanks so much for joining us today. You have a very compelling story, and it's great that you can and you're willing to share it all.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be on the program.
So tell us a little bit about the story that came to the point in which your personal discovery and how it's affected your life.
I will, and I should start by saying I have type 1 diabetes, and the book that I wrote, which is called Shot, Staying Alive with Diabetes, is about my experiences with type 1. And with the book, I hope to underscore for people outside the diabetes community what the differences are between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, because I think generally that's not very well understood.
You're right, it is not that well understood. A childhood friend of mine had what was back then called juvenile diabetes, and today I have several friends with type 2 diabetes. So this would be great if you could distinguish between the two, explain the differences.
So type 1 diabetes, which affects about 3 million Americans, is actually an autoimmune disease in which the body's own immune system attacks and destroys the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. Those are called beta cells. And so when the beta cells are destroyed, the pancreas's ability to produce insulin is never restored. It never recovers. So a person who has type 1 diabetes has no ability to produce insulin on her own and therefore must have injections of insulin every day in order to stay alive. This is the type that was formerly known as juvenile diabetes, which is a name that's probably more familiar to many people than the name type 1 is. What I didn't know about juvenile diabetes, but what I learned when I was diagnosed, was that it also strikes people in their 20s. It strikes about as many people in their 20s as it does children. So that's just in a very broad overview, type 1 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, which I think is the type most often seen in the headlines, certainly when we hear about a diabetes epidemic and when we hear about increased incidences of diabetes because of diet and lifestyle-related reasons, that's type 2 diabetes. That's the kind that affects about 20 million Americans, and that affects people as they get a little bit older and maybe become more sedentary.
We hear so much about type 2 diabetes, which so oftentimes is associated with what you eat and your diet. And then, of course, type 1. Tell us a little bit about the differences between the two in regard to diet.
Type 2 is certainly more diet-related. It's in type 2, the pancreas actually still produces insulin, but the body is unable to process it. So many people with type 2 can treat the diabetes and keep their glucose levels in a manageable and safe range by cutting fats and carbohydrates out of their diet, or reducing fats and carbohydrates, and also by exercising. One other factor that I think is not very clearly understood in diabetes is it's not about eating sweets. People don't get diabetes because they drink soda or because they eat sweets. It's about carbohydrates, because all carbohydrates turn to sugar in the blood. So eating a bagel is about the same as eating a glazed donut in terms of carbohydrate intake. That's another thing that people don't know. So for type 2 diabetes, cutting that down can reduce your glucose levels and help you manage it. Not in all cases. Some people who have type 2 diabetes can treat it with pills. There are a lot of pills that help the body absorb the insulin that it produces. But again, with type 1 diabetes, dietary changes, exercise changes don't fix the problem. You can only fix the problem by having insulin because of the autoimmune attack that has happened.
So, of course, health experts and doctors are always reminding us to watch what we eat and get enough exercise in terms of avoiding type 2 diabetes. As far as type 1 diabetes, do we know how that comes about?
Well, I mean, that's the question. So they don't know what triggers the autoimmune attack. It comes on suddenly. It comes on acutely. Most people, myself included, have some symptoms for a few weeks, and then, boom, it happens, and it never, you know, you never bounce back from that point in terms of your ability to produce insulin. So it comes on suddenly and acutely with some warning signs, but the warning signs are really only for a few weeks.
And so that from that point on, then you learn how to manage it. Is that right?
Right. From that point on, you learn how to live life on insulin, basically, which is fairly complicated. You have to balance your insulin against what you're eating, you know, how many grams of carbs you're consuming. Then there are lots of other factors that affect your glucose level that are not easy to quantify, things like your stress level and your hormones and how much sleep you've gotten. So you kind of eventually, over the years, and it can take years, figure out how all of those factors are going to be affected by the insulin that you're taking. And it's just a daily juggling act, really.
So is the management of type 1 and type 2 significantly different?
Yes, because generally, not always, but generally people who have type 2 don't need to take insulin. So they can control their type 2 through diet, through exercise, and through pills that are available to treat type 2. Some people who have type 2 do take insulin as kind of a supplement to the insulin that their bodies still produce. But the treatment is very different for type 1. Those people must have insulin every single day in order to stay alive.
So, Amy, let's talk about you and your book. The name of the book is Shot, Staying Alive with Diabetes. It's a captivating story about how it changed your life, but it's also an inspiration on how you've moved forward in life. And I think it'd be really interesting to hear about it.
Sure, absolutely. And just as an overview, I tried to write my story in a way that it might be interesting and informative to people who don't have diabetes, in addition to those who do, because most of the books about diabetes that are out there are management books or how-to books. They're kind of the ABCs of good diabetes management. And we need those books, and they're wonderful resources, but I think they're only going to be read by people who have diabetes. So I was trying to tell a very human story that might be interesting to people who don't have diabetes, just to raise awareness. And in my own case, I was 29 years old. I was about to enter law school. I was in a committed relationship with a man who I'd been dating for several years, who had two young sons. And I didn't notice, in retrospect, once I knew the symptoms, I realized that I had them, but I didn't notice that I had begun to urinate frequently, that I had been drinking a lot, water just by the liter. I was always thirsty. I was always drinking. And I had been losing weight. And I didn't notice the weight loss so much. I was very fit, and I went to the gym about 5 days out of seven. And I had a healthy diet. So I just thought maybe I was getting a little skinnier and more fit. I didn't really notice the weight loss, even though people in my gym and in my office had commented about it. And the next thing that happened is that I got a yeast infection, and I had never had one before. So I went to my gynecologist for the yeast infection, and while I was there, she took a urine sample, and she told me there was sugar in my urine, and she asked me what I had eaten for breakfast that day, and I had eaten a kind of sugary cereal. So she said, well, maybe it's just the sugar from the cereal, but we need to watch that. So I went home, treated my yeast infection for 5 days or however long the treatment was, and as soon as I stopped, the infection came right back. So I went back to the doctor. At that point, she did a glucose test, which is just a finger stick, and got a very high reading, which was 323 on the glucose meter, which is kind of way off the chart and into the danger zone, and that was my diagnosis right then and there.
Now, can one make any kind of prediction in terms of their family history on something like this?
Well, you know, I think that type 2 has a bigger genetic component, actually, than type 1. We didn't have any type 1 diabetes in my family. My grandmother had had type 2 diabetes later in life, and she was kind of a classic type 2 example because she was overweight and she ate a healthy diet but a very carb heavy diet, lots of white bread, lots of pasta, that sort of thing. And so she had type 2 diabetes later in her life, I'd say probably from the time she was about 65 until she passed away in her early 80s. But that's unrelated to my having type 1 diabetes when I got it in my 20s.
Your story, I think, also provides some encouragement that, that one can manage this and shouldn't be overwhelmed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it certainly is overwhelming in the beginning. There's a lot you need to learn. There's a lot of kind of mental hurdles to get over about having to give yourself injections every day. That's a little unusual when you start doing it, and it takes some getting used to. But there have been so many advances in the treatment, and even in the 18 years that I've had the disease, the technology has come such a long way in terms of the ability to check your glucose on a meter that will give you a very quick and accurate reading, because I, and most people who have type 1 diabetes, have to check my glucose level about 10 to 12 times a day. That's how intensive the management is. There are also now glucose meters that are called continuous glucose meters, which is a device that you wear on your body that leaves a sensor inserted under your skin. And the sensor gives you a nearly constant glucose reading at all times. I think it updates every 90 seconds or every 2 minutes or something like that, because when you're taking insulin, it's very important to know whether your glucose level is rising or whether your glucose level is falling. And you can't really feel that physically on any sort of definitive basis, usually until your glucose level is way too high or way too low. So these automatic, these continuous glucose sensors that you can wear on your body are a tremendous breakthrough.
Amy, you've really helped us understand the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which is very helpful. And, of course, you wrote the book, shot, and you also, I think, had an objective with that. What else would you want to convey to people?
I would really encourage people to connect with other people who have the disease. It can be, particularly if you're newly diagnosed, whether with type 1 or type 2, it can be an isolating condition when you're not usually around other people who are pricking their finger or giving themselves injections of insulin. And there are lots of great ways to connect with other people who have the disease that weren't really around when I was diagnosed nearly 20 years ago. I mean, that's been one of the great advances is this. There are a lot of good online communities. There are a lot of great blogs. There are a lot of interesting discussion groups. And I think that's one piece of advice that I would really give to people is to get involved and talk to other folks and share your stories among each other, share your frustrations. And, you know, there's also really a lot to be encouraged about right now in terms of research for new therapies that's going on.
Amy Ryan, thank you so much.
Well, I'd just like to thank you again for having me. I would encourage anyone who has diabetes and would like to let their friends and family know what it's like to pick up a copy of the book. I have really gotten some incredible feedback from readers who have particularly type 1 diabetes who have read the book and said that they gave it to a friend or a neighbor or an aunt or uncle who doesn't have diabetes, and that each of those people after they read it said, wow, I had no idea. And that's what I was hoping to achieve. So I'm glad that I've connected with so many people on that level and helped them to share with others outside our world what it's like to live with this disease on a daily basis.
Alive with diabetes.
That's correct.
Very good. Well, thanks so much. And
it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this BloomerBoomer.com podcast. We provide transcripts for most of our podcasts. You can click on the transcript section of the website. You can also access all of our podcasts on iTunes. Finally, we would love it if you could leave a comment, good, bad, or indifferent, in the reply section of the podcast. Thanks again.